I didn't do any research about vampire human sex because there's no content out there about that.
No, you don't need to. You can just pull from your goddamn brain.
Yeah. For that.
Welcome to Gender Forking, a Twilight Saga podcast. It's a podcast about Twilight. We're reading Twilight. My name is Sam.
My name is Lori.
This is episode 10 of season 2.
Wow.
That's crazy. First season only had 10 episodes. We did the whole book in 10 episodes. That's not happening again.
It's interesting. I wonder why that is.
I think we just really leaned into how much we can talk about Twilight.
Yeah. There's a lot here.
Should we start with like maybe a Midnight Sun update?
Yeah.
Did you notice any updates? Yeah.
The update that I caught this week is one that I was really hoping would be happening. And I think I talked about this last podcast. Stephanie is going to be creating a Midnight Sun playlist.
Yes, I saw that.
And she posted on Instagram on, well, Ficklefish, the movie production, I guess, company that she works with.
Like half her, yeah.
Posted on Instagram that she would be releasing a podcast or releasing a playlist. And they were like, which Muse song do you think is on it? And I'm like, I don't know.
Also, I was wondering today, like, is it gonna be new music? Like, does she listen to new music? What kind of new music does she like? Like,
yeah.
What's been influencing the story that is, like, older? That's coming out later this summer, right?
She didn't say when exactly, but...
Didn't you compile all the other ones in Spotify?
Yeah, I did. I can actually...
Like, forever ago?
I can send you some of the links for those. We can put them in the podcast description, but in the...
That'd be great.
Twilight Illustrated Guide, Stephanie has all of the playlists of the music that she was... listening to or inspired by or made her think of what she was writing in the four books. I made those into Spotify playlists so that people could have a place to go to for the inspiration music TM. So we can link those and you can follow me on Spotify and see A, how little I listen to music, and B, how trash the music I do listen to is. I think Mind Over Matter is my favorite chapter.
Okay, I was just thinking, I mean, I know I've said Blood Type is my favorite chapter, but I was reading the Cullens and I was like, is this my favorite chapter?
It's really good. Well, it's the first time that you get to, like, I feel like the world has really opened up.
Yeah.
You know, because they've been so vague with the details of, like, what vampires are, what they mean, like, all that kind of stuff. And, like, these two chapters, I think you really get into the, like, the ramifications of what's happening. They use the word vampire for the first time out loud in these chapters, talking to each other. It's big.
And Bella's, like, really being entrusted with a lot of secrets, which is so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do the Forks cast?
Yeah, let's do that. All right, the Forks cast today, it is 61 degrees and cloudy. Interesting, a lot cooler than it was last time we did the Forks cast, I believe, a week ago. It's going to be a rainy week this week, so in the 50s.
Love that.
Low 50s and to the mid 40s. The high was 62 today, and it'll be mostly clear with a low of 42 tonight. Air quality is good. Good visibility. Pretty humid. My ideal weather for this time of year. Doesn't matter. I'm not going outside anyway.
Do you have anything else that we should talk about before we...
I graduated this weekend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Lori graduated yesterday.
Yeah, I got my master's degree this weekend from my couch.
Yeah, well, so now here we are, two people with master's degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been really just, like, completely replacing all of the time that I spent doing homework, which honestly in the past few weeks has not been very much, with reading Twilight, so.
Yeah. Qualified.
Yeah.
So every time we say something, it is the correct thing.
Yeah.
We're
anything.
100% the authority. Yeah.
I gotta say, at the beginning of chapter 14, the vibes are excellent.
Oh my god, yeah. I think... The Edward Bella vibes throughout both of these chapters, just top tier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is peaking, and then it's about to go downhill real fast.
It really is. Edward is driving one-handed,
holding
Bella's hand. The sun is setting. Their hair is blowing in the wind. They are listening to 50s music and chatting casually.
It's, like, picture perfect right now. Also, Edward is obviously a music snob.
For sure.
It's evident a couple times in this book, but it's very evident when he says that music in the 50s were good, much better than the 60s or the 70s. Ugh, he shuddered. The 80s were bearable. What did Edward even do in the 80s?
Like, I don't know.
What the fuck has he been doing? Going to high school, going to college? Like, what did he dress like?
Yeah. What did he dress like? What, like, they can't grow out mustaches. No. They can't do their hair very drastically differently.
He's probably a Bowie fan. This is the part of the book where Edward finally tells Bella how old he is. Mm-hmm. I did an hour of research today about the Spanish influenza. And we are now at that point in the chapter, just two pages in. So
sure.
Here we are.
Pop off.
Here we go. Okay, so I was just going to, like, look into it to maybe come up with some fun facts. And also, it's very topical right now because we are also in a pandemic. So Edward was born in Chicago in 1901. Carlisle found me in a hospital in the summer of 1918. I was 17 and dying of the Spanish influenza. Okay, the Spanish influenza did not come to Chicago until the fall of 1918.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's...
Stephanie, do your research.
I know. So, like, as a global pandemic, it started in the spring of 1918, like, broadly. I don't know where it started exactly, and ended about a year later. But in Chicago, it was pretty localized from September to November of 1918. So first of all, it would not be the summer. That's just, like, factually incorrect. Also, he said that his mm-hmm. parents were already dead, so that definitely wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make any sense.
Interesting that the spread of the virus back then is probably, and I cannot emphasize enough how little I know about public health or epidemiology or whatever. Interesting that the spread was probably so much more controlled.
Yeah.
And, like, slow.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's, like, four waves of the Spanish influenza, or the 1918 virus, whatever you want to call it. The CDC calls it the 1918 virus. It's known colloquially as the Spanish influenza because I guess Spain was, like, the first country that, like, really, like, discovered it and was doing something about it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did it come from?
I don't know. I looked at a lot of stuff and, like, didn't even see anything about that.
Interesting.
But Spain was, like, one of the first countries to kind of, like, take the lead, but it was being spread by, like, military mostly. I mean, this is just after mm-hmm. a world war, so, like, in Chicago, for example, the first people that had it were military people, and, like,
makes sense.
Those guys had it, and, like, they were quarantined, but they were still allowed visitors, which was weird.
That's not quarantine.
Yeah. So they had it, and then, like, it kind of, like, seemed to go away, and then, like, but, like, it didn't, and then it spread to the entire city by late September. This period that it happened in Chicago is, like, the second wave of the Spanish influenza. I read a lot about it, and probably why I read so much about it was because of how prevalent it feels, and it was interesting to, like, read about how one city handled it. I mean, they didn't shut their schools down at all in Chicago.
Wow.
But what's interesting about this virus is that it, like, weirdly impacted young people in a way that the coronavirus is not impacting young people. So it, like, mm-hmm. was very, very deadly for people aged 15 to 34.
That's really interesting because you think of, like, those are probably the healthiest.
Right.
And, like, have the fewest pre-existing conditions.
Right. Obviously, so there was actually, like, very little deaths. Or, I mean, there were, but, like, comparatively little infection and deaths among people over the age of 65, which is, like, the opposite of what's happening now. But there were a lot of infections for, like, kids under 5. I also wanted to do some research because Edward says in the chaos of the epidemic, like, no one would realize that he was gone. It did seem, like, pretty chaotic. There was, like, some quotes from some, like, journal articles of, like, just, like, people with, like, absolutely delirious fevers doing, like, batshit stuff. And, like,
wow.
like killing themselves and their family and, like horrible stuff.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like, going into a, like, delirium and, like setting things on fire and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It was, like, chaos.
Wow.
Like, chaos.
I have no idea.
It sounded pretty wild. I mean, they, like, I guess Chicago had, like, a big, like, dance hall culture, like public, like, weekly dances. Mm. And so that was one mm-hmm. of the first things that they shut down. It was the first time it had been shut down in, like, 16 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So people were, like, really mad. At the end of this article I read, it, like, was talking about how after this all ended, everyone hated the mayor of Chicago because they felt like he handled everything really paternalistically and they were just so exhausted. So it was, like, 2 months. And in Chicago, there were 38,000 cases of this virus and also 13,000 cases of pneumonia. The population at the time was 2.7 million, so that's 373 per 100,000 people, which is actually, like, pretty standard. It's an estimated 500 million cases globally, which was a third of the population. at the time.
That's so much.
I know. Yeah, it's disturbing. Also, there's like an estimated, they don't really, they can't, they don't know how many people died globally, but the the rough estimate is 50 million, but it's anywhere between 17 and 100 million, which is a huge margin. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's so interesting, like, the different fields of study that have such a hard time, like, getting numbers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this makes sense, obviously, like, we don't, you know, we weren't keeping track of things as well back then, and it was...
Yeah, I mean, but even largely, now,
like,
we don't know.
Census was, like, through the church, but even now, yeah, we don't know.
We don't know how many cases there are.
Yeah, people are not going to the hospitals, and, you know, we don't have a perfect system where we, like, have everyone accounted for.
It'll have to be... estimates too at the end of this, although I'm sure it'll be like a little bit more accurate. The weirdest part of it is the death rate for young people. So it really tracks that Edward would get this and would be dying of it, and his parents would be dying of it. There's no like hard reason why. It's probably a mixture of genetic and social factors, since it's like post-war, and like it's probably some like class stuff playing in. But they think it's something to do with something called a cytokine storm, and cytokines are like these proteins in your cells, kind of in the way that like we have hormones, and they flood your body when you're sick. Like they give you a fever to try to fight off infection, but basically it like overwhelms your system with the cytokines, and like it's like too much, your body's doing too much, your fever's too high, and so your body's trying to save you, but then it kills you. And this is actually linked to COVID-19 deaths in young people right now.
That's really interesting.
Because so many young people died, it lowered the life expectancy of people in the U.S. by 12 years.
Holy
and I also did a bunch of reading about how they, like, learned about the virus. They weren't able to, like, do any real, like, genetic biological research on it until 1997. Because they, like, didn't have the technology before. And then it took a long time to be able to, like...
exhume graves and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. They There was a small town of Inuit people in Alaska... 80 people, 72 of them died from this virus.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and they're in a mass grave in Alaska. And so some scientists were able to extract a body that had been well preserved by permafrost and get the virus out of that woman's lungs. And recreated it in a lab in the CDC and were able to understand the RNA and how it worked, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, science is so interesting. I'm incredibly bad at it and uninterested in doing it myself, but that's really
about
cool.
The extent of the research I did.
I love that.
Thanks. I think I went into it like looking for some fun facts, and then I found out that Stephanie Meyer wrongfully said that Edward would have died in the summer, which makes no sense. And then I was like enthralled enough to continue.
I'm really curious to see like how much, if any, extra research or how like... If has she evolved in her, like, writing skill? Because, like, she's written...
A lot more since then.
Yeah, much more since she wrote Twilight. I'd be interested to see how much more thorough she is in some of this, like, researching, if she does decide to throw in little tidbits moving forward. But
yeah, it was interesting to read about, like, them using social distancing measures and, like, quarantine measures and, like, all the same things that we're doing now, because it's, like, the only thing that you can do. They didn't have antibiotics back then.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, that was my epidemiology segment.
I loved that. It's interesting, like, they start talking about this, and Bella is starting to ask questions about, like, how this whole vampire thing mechanically works. Like, how does a human being get saved by a vampire, which is in the context of, like, what they're talking about with Edward. But, like, she's like, how does he save you? And the only thing he says, like, it was difficult. He doesn't at all mention the mechanics of, like, it's a bite.
He won't tell
or, like,
her that.
Anything.
It's very interesting.
Like that. And it works differently for different, like, vampire lore.
I feel like biting
sometimes
is part of all of it,
right? Yeah. There's some sort of, like, bite thing, but I feel like in Vampire Diaries, it's, like, you have to completely drain them.
Sometimes it's an exchange of blood.
Yeah, they have to drink vampire blood, and it's, like, it's a different process. You don't just bite, because they can drink human blood in passing. They can just, like, basically, like...
They don't have to, like...
Juice box a human.
Yeah,
without turning them into a vampire, there has to be another step there, so... Huh. It's interesting that he won't go into detail about how it works, presumably because he doesn't want to open this conversation with her about, like... what it takes.
He's trying not to give her any ideas.
Just like, he's just like being really vague, and she's just like, okay.
Yeah, I feel like if I were her, I'd be like, I would just be assuming that it was through biting and maybe not understand why, but just like assume that there's some sort of biting involved. I always like am perplexed by Carlisle changing Rosalie and then being like, oh, maybe she'll be a companion to Edward, and then they fucking hate each other.
That is the funniest
heterosexism
thing ever.
At work.
It's also interesting, there's like less detail from what I remember from Life and Death here, because, you know, Life and Death is supposed to be like a standalone thing. So Edward gives less detail than Edith did about Esme and says, you know, Esme fell from a cliff and doesn't give as much background information.
I think that Esme shares it herself in one of the upcoming chapters.
Oh. I'd be really interested to see Edward's thought process in Midnight Sun through, like, what details he's willing to share with Bella and, like, what and why. Like, is he being sensitive to the fact that these are not his
stories to tell.
Traumas and stories to tell? Or is he just trying not to scare
probably
Bella?
Both. I mean, probably more the second, actually.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if he... Like, with Rosalie, like, he knows exactly what happened to Rosalie, and mm-hmm. he, like, won't think of her with any empathy. The only time that he, so far, that he's thought of her with empathy is when he's talking about how she found Emmett and carried him over 100 miles. He says, I'm only beginning to guess how difficult that journey was for her, like, in the context of him being with Bella and, like, having a human, like, be vulnerable mm-hmm. around him. That's, like, the only time he's been, like, nice to her. But the rest of the time, especially in Midnight Sun, I remember him being, like, super cruel.
How long do you think he was sympathetic to her trauma? Like, do you think at first he was like, oh, no, like, she's really fucked up.
Yeah.
You know what's really interesting? I literally just was in a webinar with Sarah Bernhardt Holiday, mm-hmm. and she was talking about the, like, the good survivor mm-hmm. doesn't want revenge and, like, goes through this, like, really, like, linear process of healing and forgives and, like, doesn't seek revenge and doesn't, like, whatever. It's really interesting because it's like, is that why Edward doesn't like Rosalie? Because does he think that she should have, like, just stepped away, like, shouldn't have, like, been so vengeful? But, like, he kills.
Yeah, I mean, he kills Charles, Esme's abusive husband.
But, like, is it only okay when, like, men step in do the
vengeance? I don't know. Like, it just doesn't make any sense that they wouldn't get along. And I don't like that they spend so much of the books not getting along, because I feel like they have so much in common, mm-hmm. both in things that have happened to them, in their personalities, are, like, dissatisfied with their existence the most out of all of the Cullens, except, mm-hmm. like, maybe Jasper, too. But Jasper seems to have worked through it a bit. I feel mm-hmm. like they want to be human the most. So I don't know why they can't just bond. Maybe it's just, like, the thing where, like, when someone's really similar to you, but you don't like those things about yourself, then you just hate that person.
I don't know what it is about Rosalie that bothers him so much, because she's like, there's nothing wrong with her.
Yeah, I know. Like,
hot take.
Even if they're just, like, fighting, like, or bickering, like, that's nothing. And I don't know. I just feel like...
I get the sense that the rest of the Cullens bicker amongst themselves.
Yeah.
This, like, Edward-Rosalie fight seems so different, especially when Jasper is, like, doing the same things as Rosalie, essentially, like, in respects to Bella, like, being like, she's too dangerous, we have to kill her. And Edward is just like, okay, that's fine, you're my brother. Kind of, like, upset about it at first, but then he's like, how dare you?
I definitely want some more insight in Midnight Sun, because we don't get it as much in the books.
This is where they start talking about how they settle into a high school so that they can stay places longer. And then they go through this, like, period of, I guess, probably, like, 10, 15 years at a spot before they move on.
That's so long.
And that involves, like, Emmett and Rosalie getting married and, like, this whole facade. It's, like, interesting because it's, like, there's really
I guess I hadn't thought about it like that. Like, I guess I always thought that they were just getting married, like, for fun over and over again.
But, like, who's going to
True,
this
like,
wedding?
They don't have any friends. You're right.
Yeah, and it's like, it seems like it would be more, it would open them up to more scrutiny if they invited, like, townspeople and, like, high school friends and stuff like that. It seems really pointless for them to have a wedding every, like, 10, 20, 30 years for just, like, the Olympic and Denali Covens to attend. Like,
maybe they're not going to bored. This page, I was thinking about Emmett and the bear, and I was thinking about how we're always thinking about Emmett in relation to grizzly bears, because that's what he's hunting, but he was actually killed by a black bear. I was looking up what kind of black bears live in Appalachia, and black bears are the only bear on the East Coast. And also, and I checked his, like, Twilight Wiki page, and it does say black bear on his page as well.
Interesting. Do you think he ever makes, like, a trip back east every now and then to just go fuck up a black bear for
probably
fun?
Yeah.
I bet he does that, like, once a year. He calls it, like, Emmett's special hunting trip, maybe for, like, his birthday or something. And he, like, drags all the Cullens back east
make
to go
watch.
Like, make his revenge on bears. That'd be really great. They make this mention that I always forget about, that the Denalis and the Olympic Coven cohabitated for a period of time because they were, like, all lived in the same way. They were all vegetarian vampires. Most of the other people are, like, nomads. Most other vampires are nomads. But they lived together for a time, and I would love to see what that dynamic
it's
was
a huge
like.
Group. Well, there's four or five of the Denali.
Yeah,
I feel like it's five, maybe.
I totally see where it's like much more suspicious
for sure,
especially because I think their ages
and
range.
It's just like Alaska, which is even it's too rural. Like, you need someplace with like a little bit more civilization to truly blend in,
especially if you're gonna be like living in a flashy way.
There's like a little bit on Jasper here. I kind of like forget this whole like redemption arc that Jasper went on before he even came into the story. I mean, like, I don't know if it's a redemption arc. It says that he became depressed where he was before, which would make sense if he's like in this really toxic, violent environment and he's an empath, essentially.
Yeah, it makes sense that he would want to be around people that were as like emotionally stable as possible. I was just, you know, thinking about his gift in these two chapters. He can't use it on himself. From what I understand, he like feels everyone else's feelings and is able to help them and then just has to sit with himself.
I'm sure,
you know?
He's better at it now, but I wonder how much he has been able to like differentiate between other people's feelings and his own.
If I was a vampire, I would simply be a therapist. Like, these people need it. Like, they can't go to regular therapy, obviously, because there's so much nuance to, like, I mean, they could learn about boundaries and stuff like that. Anyone could, but like the extra step of like, I can hear what my siblings are saying about me at all times, like I'm always aware, and like I can feel everyone else's feelings all the time, or like I'm Carlisle and I'm super compassionate, whatever that means. And like all of that is so interesting, and it's like you need people that you can openly talk to about that stuff that are not your family members that are able to like counsel you through that in some meaningful way, and like they need vampire therapists.
Hot take.
That's something that Esme could do because she loves so much, you know. She could be an excellent vampire therapist, obviously not for her family. I would not advise that people get therapy from their own family members.
She'd be a good wolf pack therapist.
She would. Like one of the people from the Quileute tribe could talk to the vampires because it's not like there's no stigma, like they know all the secrets and everything like that, and they could give some free advice to them, and then the vampires could do the same for the werewolves, because they also have that whole like everyone can read everyone's mind at all times thing, and that's incredibly invasive. Like, how awful. Also, there's this line, they're talking about Alice and how Alice's backstory is a mystery. Edward makes this comment that's like, if she hadn't seen Jasper and Carlisle and known that she would someday become one of us, aka like vegetarian, she probably would have turned into a total savage. And I'm like, is he saying that? My question is like, does he see all non-vegetarian vampires as savages, or did he think that she would be particularly ruthless?
I feel like she would. He's saying she would be particularly like feral because the vampire that created her abandoned her, so she would have no one to tell her what she is. In other vampire lore, like, it's like a vampire rule that like when you create a vampire, you're responsible for them and you have to teach them what to do.
Carlisle knew vampires were real, but he didn't know his creators either, because he fled
from them.
You know, I'm thinking about Carlisle having to figure out the specifics of like what he could and could not do. The first time he stepped out into the sun and fucking sparkled, he was like, oh shit. Like, trying to figure out like what he could and couldn't eat, or like, am I truly invincible, like what kills me, like
it's kind of weird that Alice might become like that but Carlisle wouldn't. But I guess Alice also has this other power that she could really sink into without kind of like, and kind of like lose awareness of like where she is and when she is, maybe, if it was kind of unchecked and she didn't understand. He's saying that Alice probably had some precognition, and I'm like, witches are real in this universe, and Alice was one of them. And there's also, when he's telling Carlisle's story, he's saying that Carlisle's family hunted witches, werewolves, and vampires. I'm like, great.
I wrote that too. I was saying, you know, like, Edward knows werewolves are real. Edward knows vampires are real. So why would he say witches if they weren't
lies,
real?
I guess,
You know, there's always these people that are like, Angela's a witch and stuff like that. It's like, I'll take Bella's
Alice
a witch.
Is a witch.
Everyone's a witch.
To go on to this next non-supernatural, extremely domestic part of this chapter, Bella has not eaten anything since breakfast. And I was thinking about that during the meadow scene. Like, she hikes all day and then, like, he doesn't give her a snack. She's gonna go eat dinner and she hasn't eaten since breakfast. It's fucked up.
We should talk about the elephant, in the room. Of Edward watching Bella sleep.
Yeah.
We knew we would have to talk about it eventually.
This is, like, the most problematic part of the book.
It it super is in pop culture. I want to say, first of all, of course this is wrong. Like, obviously, this is wrong on so many levels. So many. I do also hate the discourse.
I hate the discourse around it.
This being why everyone writes off Twilight. Yeah. This is obviously wrong, but if it was going to be included, I wish that it was more interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like, the degree to which Stephanie makes so many little references to it leading up to this point of, like, Bella being like, huh, my window. Huh, how'd he get in here? Like, to get my key. Like, and like, huh, like, I dreamt of Edward. That's so weird. Like, and then for it to be a, like, 3-page argument where she's only upset that he heard her
sleep talking. Yeah. Also, it's just so casually revealed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just strange. And he's, like, very non-apologetic about it. He has no remorse.
She literally says, unrepentant, what else is there to do at night? This could be so much more interesting if she was mad. What I wish was different about their relationship is that they have all of these supernatural barriers and obstacles that they get through of, like, oh, my God, you want to kill me. Oh, my God, like, we can't be together forever because I am going to die one day and you are not. And, like, oh, my God, like, this vampire is trying to kill me and you were trying to save me by leaving. All of their relationship barriers in their relationship are supernatural. And there's nothing wrong functionally. They never get into arguments about, like, boundaries. Like, this could be an excellent non-supernatural problem. That they have.
Bella almost treats it as a supernatural thing. Like, she almost is explaining it away as, like, so many other weird things are happening that this is, like, the least weird thing. She just spent the day, like, watching him run around really fast. The part that irks me a little bit is that she says that she was flattered that he did it. I'm like, that's a stretch. We can be flattered about other things that he does.
We can be excited for him to stay with us from now on. Like, that doesn't take away from that. Like, you can consensually want him there when you sleep. But, like, I just think it would be so much more interesting if she was mad.
There's a lot of misplaced fights in this book, but there should have been one here.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, like, it would be so much more interesting if she came to this conclusion that she was mad and then Edward had to think about what he did wrong. Because, like, I feel like there's very little Edward accountability in these books.
In this chapter, these two chapters, he's talking about how he's experiencing human stuff for the first time in a long time. So it's like maybe he doesn't even realize that what he did was so inhuman. But I feel like that's not true because I feel like I remember reading Midnight Sun and him being like, I'm a creep. I'm horrible. This is, I can't control it. I mean, I would like a fight, but also I think if you tweak this a little bit, I mean, and the way it is, it can be played out very comically just because of how casual they're trying to be about it.
Well, I think in these chapters, like, there's a lot of Edward being, like, in denial about his age of 17. We don't know this yet, but when we talk about immortal children, they're frozen at an age where they're immature. And a 17-year-old, no offense to all the 17-year-olds out there, is by no means, like, mature.
Yeah.
Completely. And someone who spends his time around other people that have been frozen at this young age, around high schoolers who make reckless decisions. He wants to distance himself from the fact that he is 17. But he does make stupid 17-year-old decisions, like stalking his girlfriend.
Like, I mean, in the next chapter, Edward says that Esme is really happy that they're together because she was worried that he was turned too young and that, like, that sort of thing hadn't clicked into place for him yet, so he wouldn't ever find someone to love because, like, developmentally he wasn't there, and that she was relieved that that wasn't the case. So I think it's interesting that she was thinking about that. Edward, I just feel like he has no rights in this section when he's, like, asking her not to be upset. It's like,
yeah, it's like he asks her so many other times throughout this exchange of this few chapters, like, he wants her to be upset that she's in danger all the time. He's like, why aren't you afraid of me? You're so stupid. You're not self-preserving. Yeah. Like, you are, like, so reckless that you would even go out with me on this day.
Right, and, like, choose to be around her. And when she can't choose to be around him, suddenly it's fine.
Yeah, and he's like, don't be mad. I watched you sleep. Be mad about all this other stuff. It's just so... Fuck off, Edward.
I know. It's just so not well thought out, I think, on Stephanie's part. People were enraged about that even when it first came out. Like, it's not like
for sure
the world became more woke because it kind of didn't. And so it's an interesting concept, but, like, yeah, as you were saying, it just should have been played out, like, in such a different way. It could have been way more fleshed out.
And it's over so fast.
It's over so fast, yeah.
It's, like, one of the things that I think stands out to so many people from this saga. Mm-hmm. Like, people that either read Twilight really casually when they were younger and haven't returned to it, or people that don't know anything about Twilight still know about Edward watching Bella sleep because it's, like, so disturbing.
Yeah.
But it's not talked about a lot in the book. It's really quick. And it's,
like, inadvertently extremely romanticized. I mean, that's what it gets critiqued for, I think. I mean, that's correct in that they kind of, like, are having a romantic moment after he says it to her.
This makes me wish that, like, again, like, Bella had someone to talk to who understood the supernatural stuff and didn't hate Edward by default like Jacob does coming up in the next, like, book. But if Angela was a witch and did know about vampires and werewolves, Bella could be like, oh, you know, Edward was watching me sleep, but, you know, like, it's fine. He's just a vampire. They just do that. And Angela could be like, nope.
Yeah,
bitch. Exactly. No one should do that.
Well, moving on to perhaps an equally disturbing part on the next page that I just knew that you were going to hate is that Bella drinks a full glass of milk with her dinner.
It's disgusting.
Not only does she drink a full glass of milk, but as she's scarfing down the last bites of her lasagna, she chugs the remains of her milk.
Ew.
Yeah.
Okay. Ew. Stop drinking milk, everyone. Quit. It's disgusting. Don't do it. Anti-milk. Like, Big Cow is telling you to drink milk. You don't need it. It doesn't help you. Look at where it got Bella. A few chapters from now, she's going to break her legs.
Yeah, it did not help her
bones
at
all. And
the
milk didn't help her there. So. Like... Let this be a cautionary tale.
Slippery slope.
Let me also be clear. This is not me coming for milk as an environmental or animal rights activist. I truly just think it's disgusting. I do eat dairy products. But you shouldn't drink milk. There's no reason for anyone to drink milk.
Yeah, 2005 really popped off right here. This part is funny with Charlie thinking that Bella's going to sneak out and, like, meet Mike Newton at the dance.
This is so uncharacteristic.
I know.
For Charlie and Bella. Bella's given no indication to Charlie that she would ever sneak out.
Yeah.
And
it's
Charlie
it's like,
hasn't.
Does he want her to? I don't.
I know. It's like he kind of. It kind of feels like even if she did, like, he wouldn't want to prevent her from it because he wants her to be normal. And he encourages her to go to the dance and encourages her towards Mike Newton, but then also literally detaches the battery from her
car. That's wild.
And I'm like, that doesn't seem like something Charlie would
do. That is kind of uncharacteristic. Also, Edward's the one who tells her that he did that, and Edward does the same thing in Eclipse to prevent Bella from going to see Jacob.
It's so stupid. It's like, what I don't understand is, like, Charlie is not an overbearing parent.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem characteristic for him to do that.
He
to
wants
her
to go to the dance. Like, he was trying to be like, don't you want to go with your friends?
Of course there's a difference between your daughter going to the dance and telling you about it and your daughter sneaking out. But, well, first of all, I don't think he'd be the type of parent. Second of all, he's been a parent of a teen for, like, a month now? A little more.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what date it is. Actually, I think there's a Twilight, like, wiki timeline. I'll look that up.
When did this occur to him? He's never been the parent of a teenage girl. What parenting website is he on that's like, hot tip, or like, disconnect your fucking daughter's batteries? Like, I'm sure that other parents do that. Hot take, there's some children that probably do need their batteries on their cars disconnected so that they don't sneak off and do stupid stuff, but I'm sure there's also parents that use that as, like, a form of abuse towards their children, and Charlie doesn't seem to be in either of those situations, so I just really don't understand where it's necessary. Like, Bella hasn't given him any reason to think that she is sneaking out and doing anything deviant. There's no reason for Charlie to suspect that she's on drugs or, like, hanging out with the wrong crowd or anything like that. So, like, I don't think it's necessary, like, to do that.
It's Saturday, March 12th on day. Most of this book takes place in March.
Pisces season.
I know. March 2nd is when Bella is asked to the dance by Mike, Eric, and Tyler. March 18th is when Bella awakes in the hospital with multiple injuries.
I know that people talk about this all the time, but it really does happen
so fast. Yeah.
I'd like to think of myself at 17 as a normal child in many respects. And I'd love to ask you this question as well.
Okay.
Would you have allowed Edward in your house while your parents didn't know he was there?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm sure I would.
I would have been so against that. I never would have done
Edward's,
it.
Edward specifically, like, because of, like, all the supernatural stuff, I probably would have done that. I don't know if I would have done it with, like, anyone else.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking of, like, the place that I lived when I was 17, and it was not conducive to sneaking. Like, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment with my mom, so it was, okay. Like, there was no way she wouldn't hear everything going on in right. my life. This is a different circumstance, but, like, I don't think that I would have been able to, anxiety-wise,
yeah.
handle the lying.
Gotcha. I'm going to go ahead and say that I would be able to lie. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird, though. I was like, can, like, they're talking to each other. Like, can Charlie hear that? I don't know. Like, that would stress me out.
Yeah. It's also lucky, I guess, that Bella doesn't have siblings. If you're sneaking someone in the house, you're also sneaking them past your siblings, probably, I guess, if you have siblings.
Yeah, unless your siblings are, like, super cool.
I guess if they're super cool and they've never betrayed you to your parents before.
Yes, which is unlikely.
I was thinking about, like, how in my ideal Twilight, Bella and Beau are twins.
Yeah,
and
I do like
they would
that.
Have to probably communicate.
Do they both move to Forks together? Or, like, yeah. did one of them get raised by Renee and the other one got raised by Charlie?
Parent trap.
Parent trap Twilight? Edward doesn't fit into the story
it.
At all.
No. I think it's just, like, so situationally perfect that Bella's an only child and her dad is usually not suspicious.
Yeah,
but seems to be
out.
Here.
I mean, he gets more hands-on after the first time she runs away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be exhausting to be a parent and have something like that happen and you're like, damn, I have to, like, really ramp up my job right now,
yeah.
you know?
She says that none of the boys have caught her eye yet, and then she's like, I was careful not to overemphasize the word boys in my quest to be truthful with Charlie. It's like, okay, that's gay. But
it's gay. if he heard that and she was like, no, I'm not interested in any of the boys. And,
yeah.
Like, he wouldn't think, like,
vampire.
Oh, she's in love with a vampire man.
Yeah.
He would think she's a lesbian.
Which is more realistic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That would be what we would do in our adaptation of
oh,
this
yeah. Yeah.
into a rom-com. We would mm-hmm. make Charlie think for
a long time
that Bella was gay and in love with, like, Alice or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, or Jessica.
And she would be.
Yeah, she would be. He says, well, you're all too good for them anyway. And I was like, that's mm-hmm. true. And he
it
says,
is.
Wait till you get to college to start looking. She says, every father's dream that his daughter will be out of the house before the hormones kick in.
On page 298, we have my favorite line in the book. It is, the familiar smell of my shampoo made me feel like I might be the same person I had been this morning.
That is so you.
I know. I'm like, I literally, like, the smell of my shampoo is so calming. First of all, I have 3 shampoos and I rotate them based on mood, not on the condition of my hair. I have one nostalgia shampoo. Anyway, I love that line. I think it's perfect. The strawberry shampoo is iconic.
She brings her pajamas to the bathroom with her, whatever. But then mm-hmm. she grabs a bag of toiletries off the desk. Why doesn't she keep her toiletries in her own bathroom?
I know. It's really weird. It's like a dorm that she's
yeah.
sharing with Charlie. And it's like, I highly doubt that both of them are bringing, like, a shower caddy and flip-flops to the bathroom. Like, that's her dad.
Can you imagine?
Like, you don't even do that when you, like, go shower at other people's houses.
I know.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
it's
just,
so
like,
weird.
Bring your toothbrush and your pajamas and fuck off.
Maybe she hasn't unpacked.
Maybe she's only been there for a couple of months. I don't know.
She's, like, so organized that, like, she would be unpacked.
What kind of shower do you have that you don't have room for the products that you need to take a shower? So Bella doesn't seem to, like, be particularly invested in, like, a very thorough hygiene routine. Like, I'm sure she's doing everything she needs to do to get clean, but she's not, like, she never makes mention of, like, 50 products she uses.
No.
To, like,
she doesn't
whatever.
Do a face mask. Yeah. The sort of, like, zaniness that mm-hmm. she's feeling, like, the kind of anxiety that she's going through when she's going through her, like, nightly routine really reminds me of that chapter in Breaking Dawn before they have sex.
Oh my god, yeah.
When she's, like, being extremely thorough.
Does she think that's about to happen right now?
I don't know, maybe. But then she does say, this is, like, my favorite. I pulled on my holy t-shirt and gray sweatpants, too late to regret not packing the Victoria's Secret silk pajamas my mother got me 2 birthdays ago. Renee. Renee.
Renee.
Renee did that.
Renee and Alice
yeah.
really did that.
Yeah,
you bought
they
a 15-year-old Victoria's Secret pajamas. She also makes mention, like, they're still somewhere back home, and she's still calling Phoenix
home.
which is interesting. I wonder how long it takes her to really settle into Forks and feel like it's home, because by the end of the book, she's really adamant that she's not going back to Phoenix.
Home is where your silk pajamas are, and also where you pack. You don't keep your toiletries in a bag that doesn't live in the bathroom.
Home is where your vampire boyfriend watches you sleep.
I need a sign. A kitchen sign with that on it. Like a live, laugh, love. But like a home is where your vampire boyfriend watches you sleep. Oh my God.
Yeah. She runs downstairs and tries to convince Charlie she's not sneaking out. And then she goes and she has a sexy evening.
Talk about that. Edward is so happy here, which is really cute. He's just like really pleased with himself for being able to be in this situation at all.
He should be more awkward. He hasn't touched a single person other than his siblings in like literally years, probably. And like they make all these mentions like Edward's rubbing my back. Edward was just
like pulled me naturally to him. Yeah.
Yeah, like existing. And it's like, that's, you know, he's graceful because he's a vampire, sure, but he's got to be awkward. He's a 17-year-old who probably never engaged with someone in this level, because it wouldn't have been appropriate way back
when. I feel
like
he reads a lot, though.
Maybe he's just like, you think he's constantly practicing with like Emmett or like a doll?
A pillow, yeah.
Like, Emmett, let me practice rubbing your back. Is this good for you?
I don't think that he would willingly practice, but I do think, well, I mean, he's watched all of his family be affectionate towards each other and their own romantic partners, and I bet there was a situation where they were trying to coach him maybe very recently on how to be with Bella romantically.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure that he's been subjected to, like, Emmett projecting thoughts into his head of, like, what is and isn't appropriate date behavior and mannerisms.
They're kind of, like, talking about the high of first love, which is very, like, poignant because this is a book about the high of first love.
Yeah.
Which I found sweet and interesting, but also this whole section where he talks about how he's jealous of Mike Newton.
Like, of all the human things that Stephanie includes in Edward's personality, so boring that jealousy is one of them. Like, why would he, why would he just have to be jealous? It's such an old,
it makes
tired
sense for like the possessiveness that he's constantly exhibiting.
Yeah, but he should be able to look at Mike Newton and be like, look at that fucking
shrimp.
Shrimpy boy.
Well,
but
he
she's
says
expressed no interest
she like actively dislikes and has, like, actively turned down at least two times. He does say, I knew that if I continued to ignore you as I should, or if I left for a few years till you were gone, that someday you would say yes to Mike or someone like him. It made me angry. That's on 303. How are you so sure that she would end up with Mike or someone like him? What does someone like him mean? Does that mean human?
It also is interesting because he says this in direct, like, explanation for why he watches her sleep at night.
Yeah.
He says, the first night I came here was the night that Mike asked you to the dance, and I was torn about what was right, moral, and ethical, and what I wanted. And that's when he says, like, why I did it is because I knew that you would be with him eventually if I didn't pursue you. And it's like,
yeah, he came into her room out of jealousy.
Yeah, I don't,
it's weird,
understand. Some people take jealousy as like a compliment, and I think it's extremely annoying.
I am in the same boat. I think it's very annoying.
It's like, you can be clingy and sweet in other ways, but the second that you like talk about jealousy, I'm like, that's so unrelatable.
It's possessive, and it's like, you're your own person, and like, other people need to recognize that. And it also implies a lack of trust, usually, kind of, no matter what the situation is.
Totally. Also, like, it should be enough for him that Bella's not interested.
Yeah.
And, like, he doesn't seem to distrust that Bella's not interested. He just, like, is unable to think clearly because of this jealousy.
He still has not told her that she's pretty or beautiful or that he is attracted to her. Even when she outright asks, he doesn't do it. Bella is exhibiting jealousy in this section, too. Jealousy of Rosalie. Every single time she talks about Rosalie, it's through the context of her appearance.
It's like, Edward really hasn't given her much to go on other than that, though.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, other than that, and, like, maybe Carlisle intended them for one another. I just feel like he's not taking the hint, like, that she needs to hear that in some way.
Right. The way that he talks about, too, like, for almost 90 years, I've walked among my kind and yours all the time. I was thinking I was complete in myself, not realizing what I was seeking and not finding anything because you weren't alive yet. And I'm like, there has to be a nicer way to phrase
right.
like, this. I think he needs to be a little bit more specific about why he likes her than just, like, I like you because it's a given. Like, I'm so drawn to you. It's about your blood and, like, that stuff. It's like
explain it. In this section, he tells her that she smells very floral, like lavender or freesia. I'm like, let's bottle that. That sounds great.
Let's bottle it. And that doesn't really say to me, I want to eat that.
No, I don't want to eat a flower. I don't know. It's weird what he compares smells to.
Yeah, like the, just like, because I'm resisting the wine doesn't mean I can appreciate the bouquet. Ew. Also, like, some people enjoy eating lavender things, but I don't think that they often have a craving for the taste of
maybe
lavender.
Maybe he doesn't, maybe it's not a taste. I mean, isn't taste just 90% smell? So maybe it's just 100% for vampires.
Oh, is taste 90% smell?
Yes. I don't know.
90% smell, 10% mouthfeel.
Your blood has great mouthfeel. No claws.
Ew. Ew.
He mentions on 307 that the Cullens try to, like, rise above the hand that they've been dealt and, like, not be monsters and try to be good people, which I think they do by not killing anyone, but it's like, what else are they doing? Carla is the only person who, like, is an active member of society. The rest of them are just passively not killing anyone.
Right, yeah. They have the opportunity to be incredible advocates for so many things and throw so much money behind so many different causes. And I'm not saying that they're not doing it because, like, it's possible that that's going on somewhere in the family and that Edward isn't just, like, going to bring it up or something like that. But, you know, if I had essentially what is unlimited money and resources and time, there are a lot of things that I would want to accomplish. Yeah. It could be especially good because I think a lot of people will do good for the clout, and vampires cannot become famous, so it would be like an extremely selfless act for them to throw their weight behind a cause and have to ensure that they're not going to become famous from it because they can't be in the public eye. You know, this really opens something up for me that I'm really curious about. What is Stephanie doing with her money?
I don't know. What's her net worth?
I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it too hard. I mean, I do, but I've stopped myself from thinking about it too hard because, you know, realistically, like, we all, the Twilight fandom, have given Stephanie quite a bit of money. Her values are different than mine. I think that's really clear. I'm wondering, like, what does she donate to? Like, what does she think is really important? I don't know if her creatures or her characters or whatever would be a reflection of her values, especially, like, thinking about this now in relation to, like, how problematic and, like, transphobic J.K. Rowling is. You know, she's obviously doing a lot of harm to the trans community by, like, just even speaking, but I'm curious to see, like, what kind of money she throws behind things.
Her like, net worth, this isn't necessarily how much money she has, but her net worth is $125 million. The Twilight films have grossed $1.8 billion at the box office globally.
I was just talking to JJ about that, like, last night. We were talking about, like, I feel like some authors just get to, like some people get to retire and live off of their wealth, like, creative people. And then do passion projects. You know, I'm really curious to see, like, what kind of stuff Stephanie does with her money, if anything, or if she's just funding her, like personal projects, because she's obviously throwing a lot of money into things that are not quite as successful as Twilight. Like, the Fickle Fish films have not necessarily stood on their own, so I'm sure there's a lot of, like, bankrolling.
Most notably, she's given money to the American Red Cross. Yes, I have a copy of Brie Tanner right here, and it says, $1 from each book sold will be donated to the American Red Cross. Blood.
That's just kind of kitschy.
Yeah, it is.
You know, like, Stephanie Meyer's donating money to the Red Cross because she wrote a book about vampires.
The first thing you see when you look up Stephanie Meyer philanthropy is a website called looktothestars.org, and it says Stephanie Meyer charity work, events, and causes, and it's a picture of her, and it says charities, zero, causes, zero.
Ouch. I'm really wondering, like, how much money she donates to the Mormon Church.
Honestly, there's a 2008 opinion piece in the New York Times called Sucking the Quileute Dry.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I'm most curious about. We know because they've publicly stated it on their websites that Stephanie and Summit Entertainment and etc., Fickle Fish, all of that stuff have never, like, compensated the Quileute for the amount of money that they have gotten from their imagery and their, you know we say that every episode, but it's worth repeating that they have a ton of money.
We have to say it every episode.
And, you know, Twilight put Summit Entertainment on the map, made them into the production company that
they
are.
Well, I guess the answer is that she's done nothing. So we can't expect the Cullens to even do anything. She wouldn't know what that's like.
I have thoughts.
Okay.
on vampire sex.
Please.
In this section, Bella starts asking about marriage. Yes. And is like, is that marriage between, like, Rosalie and Emmett the same as it is for humans? Which is, you know, extremely vague way of her trying to ask about mm-hmm. sex. And Edward picks up on it, whatever. It's really important to note that they have been on two dates. And
so after the third.
This is wild. She's like, I did wonder about you and me someday, dot, 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 dot. And he freezes, and he's like, that's not possible. And he starts talking about how it's really dangerous for them to be that close to each other, and, like, most importantly, that, like, I could kill you by accident, like, if I lost control at all. Basically, it's like, you're really breakable. I can't lose control around you, so it's not possible. I have never thought about it in this way that I remember, but I just don't understand what he means by losing control. Because there should never be anything that happens during sex that should make someone lose control. Yeah. Human or vampire. Yeah. Like, that's fundamentally misunderstanding sexuality. Right. Like, you're... anyone's, like, sexual involvement or arousal does not make them lose control of themselves. And it shouldn't. And I don't know if that's something that Stephenie Meyer just misunderstands.
About male sexuality, like, in particular.
Yeah, I think she's, like, misapplying this, like, myth that men are animalistic mm-hmm. and, like, need, like, sex. And, like, when they get it for the first time, or when they get it for the first time in a mm-hmm. long time, or when they get it at all, like, that they completely lose control. Like, that is so obviously mm-hmm. damaging. But, like, it's the crux of why Edward and Bella cannot have sex. And it is a major plot point for, like, the rest of this saga until Breaking Dawn. This is incorrect. Like, it doesn't happen in humans, and she gives no biological or, like, supernatural reason why it should happen to Edward. And Bella just accepts mm-hmm. it and is like, yeah,
like, it's so sucks, not, you know? Inventive. Like, they are both thinking about sex here in a way that is extremely all or nothing. For some reason, it never crosses their mind to, like, start really small. Like, why don't they have oral sex? Like, why don't they
never? And,
like, there's, like, so many solutions I can think of.
There's so many. And it's also just, like, it's all hinged on this, like, we're going to have penetrative sex, and the second that Edward experiences any pleasure, it's all out the window. He could do anything to Bella, and he wouldn't be accountable for it. It would be this, like, thing that takes over. And it's like, if that's what happens to vampires, you need to say that, because it's not what happens to humans. It's just not true. And, like, I don't understand. Like, what is she trying to say?
I don't know. It's so frustrating. Like, it could really be solved in so many ways. Like, they could just so easily... like, why can't he just finger her? Like, why can't he do that? Like, if he's so worried about physically losing control of his body, I'm sure that they could get some restraints that are tough enough to hold back a vampire.
Yeah. Like, hot take, another vampire.
Another vampire could be there. I'm sure there are vampires who are into that.
Let's introduce Emmett into the
It would be Emmett.
It would be Emmett. He'd have, like, a blindfold and, like, headphones blasting music. And he's, like, wrestling. Be, like, holding Edward back. Oh, no.
We fixed it. That's so vivid in my brain. It could really start, though. Like, if they did have some restraints, it could just really start, give them a kinky start to their sex life.
Absolutely. It's so upsetting, this, like, complete dismissal of, like, male sexuality as just, like, uncontrollable thing that, like, rules over men. And this is pervasive in this book. It's also pervasive in popular culture. And it's like, maybe Stephanie really believes that that's how it is. And maybe, like, no one has ever explained to her that that's not how it works. If Edward is, like, does he really believe this? Like, has he ever engaged in this conversation with his siblings? Like, that's why it makes me think that Stephanie is the one that's projecting this onto him. Because if he had spoken to, like, Emmett or Jasper or Alice.
Or even heard, like, their thoughts. Or accidentally.
Yeah.
At the end of that, she's like, do you find me attractive at all? And he doesn't even say mm-hmm. yes. He says, I may not be human, but I am a man. And it's like, that's not the same thing.
Disgusting.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
Also confirmed they're virgins in this section.
Yes. Yeah. This confirms that they're virgins. Yeah.
So that's the end of the chapter. Also, I was thinking in this section more about how cold Edward feels. So I Googled how cold does a corpse feel? Because that's...
Thank you.
Yeah. That's got to be what it feels like, right?
Is it just like room temperature?
It is room temperature. But because of thermodynamics, different things conduct temperature in different ways. So like when you touch like a surface that is room temperature, it's going to feel colder than your body, even though it's like, I mean, it is, it's whatever the room is. But it's why like water and air at the same temperature feel very different. So a body that is room temperature will feel cold to the touch because it's like the same texture as you basically, but it's just a lot colder than the normal human body temperature. So it gets described as icy. And I mean, whenever you talk about or read about dead bodies, they're described as cold, but they're not frozen unless they've been in a morgue, you know? I was just thinking about that as they were cuddling on the bed. So it's time for our mini segment, Love at First Bite. It's my turn. Yay. The first photo is this person on a front porch, just like smiling at the camera. The second photo, a photo of like painted hands, like handprints, like when you paint your hand and you put them like for kids, like, but all the hands are like adult sizes. And then a photo of this person volunteering at a children's hospital. This is a loose interpretation. The caption is, even the darkest night will end and the sun will rise, because I feel like they're a Les Mis fan. And the song is Love Me Tender by Elvis Presley.
Okay. This is Esme.
Yeah.
The children's hands, but like adult-sized is very good.
Thank you.
Swipe right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, obviously.
Write in and let us know if you'd swipe left or right on Esme. Now moving into chapter 15. Yep, the colon.
This is amazing. I love this chapter.
It's a good
great
chapter.
Energy, hilarious, a little weird. It's amazing. So when Bella like does her human stuff, how is she not super self-conscious about Edward hearing all of that stuff?
Maybe she's just in denial. Like, she knows she has to live with it, so she's just like, I'm gonna pretend like it's not happening. But I know, yeah, like, you can't, like, I like to just imagine, like, Bella having to, like, shit and, like, playing the loudest music possible so that he can't hear it. Like,
yeah. I just can't get over that. I would be like, we can't date. I can't go to your house because I can't have everyone hearing, like, the sounds of my intestinal system all the time. Bella has some more milk with her breakfast. She has cereal, so.
Bella drank water challenge. This girl is dehydrated. Do they even bring water with them to hike?
I know, like, right? In the cold light of day, Edward's like, breakfast time. And now I'm just imagining him like bringing like a snack bag for Bella wherever he goes. Like a parent, like a diaper bag with snacks in it. It has like a first aid kit, like all kinds of stuff.
Well, maybe this isn't even a problem for Bella because she drinks so much dairy. That, like, she's probably not pooping very much.
You know? Or too much if she's actually lactose intolerant and unaware. I think this is my favorite page of, like, the book. From the bottom of 314 and, like, most of 315. Like, this whole back and forth where he's, like, breakfast time and she, like, pretend, like, covers her throat. Like, that's so funny. And then he carries her downstairs over his shoulder. And then he's, like, what do you want for breakfast? And he's like, wait, I don't know how to do anything with food. And then she just eats some cereal in front of him.
Yeah.
Like, that's hilarious.
She, like, kind of, like, plays it up, like, you know, what am I going to have? What are you going to make me for breakfast? And I wish that she would have just, like, let him struggle. And, like,
I would love to see what he came up with.
French toast. Just go ahead and make that for me. Edward hasn't ever cooked, probably. Like, literally ever. Like, I'm sure that his mom cooked.
That's probably why all the Twilight recipes out of the cookbooks are horrible.
Yeah, what we really deserve from this Midnight Sun launch is a better Twilight cookbook.
Oh my god, yeah.
And maybe I will be the one to write it this time.
And then he's just like, let's go meet my family.
He mentions that the Cullens have taken bets on whether...
Yes!
on whether Edward would bring her back.
Yeah.
And I really cannot wait to see that scene Midnight Sun.
Oh my god.
Of them taking bets on, like,
yes. That's hilarious.
I feel like I can't wait. There is a bit here on the next page on 317 mm-hmm. where she's looking at him in the middle of the kitchen and calls him the statue of Adonis again. Mm. He is constantly being compared to Adonis, and I think this is a trope in literature. This is obviously not, like, Stephanie Meyer was not, like, you know, she wasn't doing something where she was comparing Edward to Adonis, but I wanted to read a little bit about Adonis because I think it's interesting that she's compared Edward to Adonis recently, and then I think it's going to be really important for us to read up on some of the comparisons to Hades and Persephone moving forward into Midnight Sun with the pomegranate stuff. So I wanted to bring in a little bit of that before.
Absolutely.
So Adonis is a god of Phoenician origin, and I have this book that my roommate lent me, and it has just like a little line about all of the gods under their name, just to like a summary basically. And so, for example, Achilles is an impassioned man. Helen is the woman loved by men. And some of them are just like really funny. I've been like flipping through it. Adonis is the precocious seducer.
Ooh.
He is very handsome. That's like one of his like things, right? So Aphrodite gathered him up and concealed him in a chest, which she gave to Persephone, the goddess of hell. Persephone refused to give Adonis back, however, as she, like Aphrodite, had fallen in love with a young man. Zeus meditated in the quarrel between the two goddesses, and it was decided that Adonis should spend 1/3 of the year with one and 1/3 of the year with the other, and then the remaining third with whoever he chooses. And so Adonis, however, chose to spend 2/3 of the year with Aphrodite. And it says, one can see in this myth a personification of the productive forces of nature and seasonal cycles. He is young, tall, and handsome. According to some things, when he died, Aphrodite cried so much she cried one drop of tear for each drop of blood that Adonis lost. And each of those tears turned into a rose, which was the gardens of Adonis. I think it's interesting that they're referring to Adonis, and then moving into Midnight Sun, we're going to be talking more about like this Hades and Persephone thing.
Right.
So very interesting, this like Persephone falls in love with Adonis after she's with Hades.
Right.
It seems like Zeus is like, that's fine, you can still have him for a third of the year. So the math here is like half the year Persephone is with Hades, and then a third of it she's with Adonis, and then it's like, do those overlap? Like, what's happening here? It's very interesting. It's like very interesting because he doesn't seem to be anything like Edward in any way other than like he's beautiful, but he seems to be more like torn, like Bella.
Yeah.
This is like maybe the original love triangle.
Yeah.
And the solution is honestly so much better.
Sharing.
I'm hoping that there's more of this like this Greek and Roman god parallels being drawn as we move into Midnight Sun, especially because I just spent the year learning Latin for seemingly no purpose, but
here's your purpose.
You know, maybe I'll be able to put that to use here.
Yeah. There's this part on 317 also where Edward's like, well, don't you want to introduce Charlie to me like as your boyfriend? And Bella's like, no.
Basically. And Edward's weirdly like persistent about it. He asks once, and then she's like, I don't know, and then just like is eating her cereal, and he's like, are you gonna tell Charlie that I'm your boyfriend or not?
Yeah.
Like, he literally says it.
He says that. He demands it. She's like, you don't have to pretend for me. And he's like, I'm not pretending. And it's like, yeah, he's not pretending.
Yeah, he really just wants to be her boyfriend.
And she's like, I thought we were more than that.
It's weird because it's like, at this point, Bella, I guess, just hasn't wrapped her head around the fact that Edward is the most conventional person she's ever going to meet. Like,
yeah.
He's so traditional. He is so down.
I don't think
this.
It really hits her until like the end of New Moon when he proposes to her.
Oh my God. I would be so shook.
318. She's got to decide what to wear to meet the vampire family. She says, I doubted there were any etiquette books detailing how to dress when your vampire sweetheart takes you home to meet his vampire family. I'm like, based off of this outfit, there should be.
There should be. Literally, I cannot believe the choices. And I know we've talked about this before.
I know.
But I'm gonna say it again. There is no excuse for what she wears.
But
I'm trying to find, there was, okay, go ahead.
She does say khaki colored skirt, so it's not necessarily made of khaki material.
I understand we want to reclaim this traumatic fashion moment from this book, and we want to make it seem better than it is. And I understand, like, yeah, we can reimagine what this is going to look like, but we need to stop giving Stephanie the benefit of the doubt. Have we seen her? Like, this is 2005. We know her background. We know her fashion choices. We know her judgment.
Yeah.
We need to stop giving her the benefit of the doubt. I I understand the need to reclaim parts of Twilight. We do it with Renesmee. We do it with pretending that Renesmee and Jacob aren't in love. We do it with all these things. Like, we pretend that he didn't literally, like, watch her sleep. Like, we try to, you know, make it as good as possible, but we cannot give her the benefit of the doubt with these fashion choices, because I'm telling you, look at what Stephanie Meyer wears. Look at who she is. She is not making good fashion choices.
Yeah.
I can promise you this is as bad as you think it is.
And then, like, in addition to her putting it on, Edward's like, you are utterly indecent. No one should look so tempting. It's not fair.
Bet. And another thing.
And another thing.
And another thing. This just confirms that Bella's, like, definitely canonically skinny, because skinny girls can wear anything they want because everything is made to look good on them. Like, they are made with them in mind, and she could just wear a khaki skirt and a button-down top and probably like, look it's fine.
Yeah.
And then, like, that just is unfair. Yeah, people are like, I could wear that, and I'm like, great, Bethany, I'm happy. Like, good luck getting a button down that will, like, not burst open every time I breathe, like, from my boobs.
I don't know, maybe it is a really tight on her, though, because he kisses her and she fucking passes out, so I don't know if she has restricted airways.
I forgot that this happened. I read this and I was like, the fuck.
I couldn't believe. I forgot that happened. It's so funny. It's like, you're too good, far too good. It's like, all he did was, and I quote, he tilted his head slowly and touched his cool lips to mine for the second time, very carefully parting them slightly. That's all. That's all he did. And it's so good. He's just such a good kisser that she passes the fuck out. It's like, so, I hate that. 3:20 and 3:21, we're driving to the Cullens' house, and we have some descriptions about where it is and what it looks like. I was looking at Google Maps. They take her truck. They pass over the bridge at Kalawa River, which is the river that's north of Forks. The major road, I think it's the 101, goes over that bridge and goes north. The house is flashing past us, growing further apart and also bigger. So, like, presumably this is a wealthier part of town. I don't know if that's, like, actually true to Forks, but... And then there's no more houses at all, and it's just the forest. And I'm thinking that they're driving for quite a long time. I mean, they are in the truck, so he's probably driving at a normal speed. There is another river right there, the Solduck.
Yeah, the Solduck.
They're driving for so long that Bella's getting a little impatient, and then they drive down a long, unpaved road for a long time as well, and then they're at the house. So it's, like, pretty out of the way. I was looking at Google Maps and, like, I mean, it's, like, definitely imaginary road, obviously. But the house is near a river, so there's the Solduck River, so it's either on that or off of one of its tributaries.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't drive that much farther north without running into Beaver, which is the next town.
And Sappho, which is right next to it.
They do this description of the house, which is something that is a huge departure from the book description in the movie. They choose a very different-looking house. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's because the house that they're describing probably just doesn't exist, or doesn't exist in the area that they were looking to film in, and they probably could not construct a house for this lower budget first movie. But they describe it as a timeless, graceful, and 100 years old, probably. Mm-hmm. It was painted a soft faded white, 3 stories tall, rectangular, well-proportioned. The windows and doors were part of the original structure, or a perfect restoration. That's what they describe from the outside, and it's just so different from the blackened wood modern house.
The really movie. Modern house in the movie. I mean, the inside is a bit more modern, I think, but the outside, at least the front, is very traditional. And I tried to do some research on who would have built this house 100 years ago, north of Forks, like, in the middle of nowhere.
Kind of makes me think that they did build it.
I mean, they were there, like, 100 years ago, weren't they?
Yeah.
So it might have been them.
They do cycle through. Yeah, they could have built it back then and just, like, updated what they wanted to.
That would make more sense because Forks, I think, wasn't incorporated as a township until 1945. I think that's what I read. But, like, people weren't even, like, white people weren't even out there until 1860. So, like, the 100 years thing tracks if it's not the Cullens. But yeah, it would make more sense if it was just them.
But it would have, it wouldn't necessarily make sense for there to be this huge,
perfectly, like, suitable house next to a river in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. For 100 years,
imagine being on the housing market as, like, a vampire that needs, like, such specific things and such, like, retreat and, like, whatever.
Me and my five adult children. Forks is a logging town, has, like, a logging history, although I looked on the Wikipedia page today and the logging industry has gone down and the tourism has gone up, but also since there's less logging now, a lot of the jobs apparently are in the corrections facilities, and I do not love that.
That's fascinating. I mean, that tracks for Charlie, which is really, you know, small town America is really interesting.
Yeah, the inside is a lot less traditional. The whole back of the house is glass and looks over the river. So this is where we meet Esme for the first time. Mm-hmm. Incredible. Love her. Carlisle is also there. I've always found it very interesting the way that they speak to Bella here. Carlisle says, "You're very welcome, Bella." And Esme says, mm-hmm. "It's very nice to know you."
This is saying? The way that all of them should be speaking. Yeah. It makes sense. Like, Esme seems a lot more isolated than the rest of the Coens because mm-hmm. they don't explain if she's working or if she's literally just, like, dicking around all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, true.
Like, the
we don't
kids
know.
Are... Kids are, like, getting up on the slang at school, and they're, like, very much, like, in the weeds of, you know, yeah. the culture, and, like, Carlisle, he goes to work every day, and it makes sense that she would be a little more antiquated in her mannerisms if she's not surrounded by people all the time, but because we don't really know. What I think is interesting is that they describe her as softer and rounder than the rest and less angular than the others. And, you know, the only reason I could think of for this is that she gave birth while she was a human.
Maybe.
Is that something that's going to change how Bella looks? Because she gives birth while she's a human and then becomes a vampire, you know? So, like, is she gonna be round like Esme and then, like, Rosalie and Alice are just angular because they were, like, not moms?
This is a great Alice moment. Alice mm-hmm. bounding in, kissing Bella on the cheek, telling her she smells nice. Love that.
Absolutely
and
iconic.
Everyone's mortified that she does it, and I'm horrified. I am not, though, and Bella loves it.
Jasper's there to, like, compensate with for it because he, like, is using this, like, feeling of calm and ease that Bella feels like it's coming from Jasper. I wonder, like, to what degree that is helpful or harmful in, like, all these different situations. I think it's different, like, moving forward, like, it could be really helpful when you're feeling stressed for no reason, but I think sometimes it can be harmful because, like, Bella has a problem not taking danger seriously. Mm-hmm. And, like, if she's being put at ease all the time by Jasper, that could be unhelpful because, like, your body tells you you're in danger sometimes. Like, some people have, you know, anxiety that doesn't help them and is unfounded and is not about, you know, real danger, but sometimes your body's telling you in danger because you
I think his power is so interesting. It's the most nuanced power of everyone in the Cullens, I believe. Mm-hmm. Bella's really observant through this whole thing. She's, like, catching all of their glances, all the dynamics. Also, Rosalie and Emmett are not there. Bella doesn't come from a big family. Like, she only has her parents. Her grandparents are dead, I think. She doesn't have any cousins. She just has her parents, and she only has one of them at a time. So, like, entering into this environment is, like, probably hugely meaningful for her in a way that is, like, not just because it's vampires or Edward's family. It's just, like, a family that is accepting her into their home. So this is the part where Bella learns that Edward can play piano. There's a very sweet back and forth between Edward and Esme here. Love that very much for both of them and for Bella and for me.
You know what I really like here is that Bella mentions, like, she wanted to buy her mom a piano.
I know. I loved that little interlude there.
It was so sweet. It's like, Bella is like, if I won the lottery, I wanted to buy a grand piano for my mom. She's not even good. She only plays on their secondhand upright piano, but she likes to watch her play. It would be so sweet because, like, you know, we know Bella is eventually going to be a vampire and, you know, all of the privileges that come along with that, including, like, the literal endless stream of money, apparently, that we is never really explained other than
except
maybe
for
Alice,
like, saying stocks one time.
But if Bella followed through one day and got Renee a piano, like, that would be so sweet.
What if she does it, like, after she becomes a vampire and she's, like, missing her mom? We never get any mention of Renee after she becomes a vampire, so whatever.
Never. So. Never even how she explains it to her. She just, like, decides not to or something like that. Yeah, very sweet, like, mother-son and mother-daughter stuff here.
He mentions that Alice saw some visitors coming soon, alluding to the nomads that are coming. And then my favorite part of the entire saga, he finishes playing Bella's lullaby on the piano, and she cries a couple tears, and then he wipes them away, and then he puts it in his mouth to taste it, and it's never discussed again.
What did he think? What
I don't know.
Think?
I don't know.
Did he think it would taste good?
Like, I don't know. Like, I cannot explain this in any way, just like I can't explain so much of his behavior.
I don't even want to get too far into the science of this, but, like, if all things that are not blood to him taste like dirt, why would that be any different?
It's obviously, like, very an impulsive thing for him. I need Midnight Sun. I need Midnight Sun so bad.
I need
Midnight Sun. That's all.
And, like, just so that Stephanie has to, like, fucking
own
write this
up to
again.
That. Yeah.
Own up to the fact that Edward has to be like, Oh, she's crying. Oh, I'm going to reach out and grab that. Oh my God, that was so weird of me. Why did I do that?
She says, I looked at him questioningly and he gazed back for a long moment before he finally smiled. Do you want to see the rest of the house? They just move on. How do you move on from that ever?
How do you move on? Sam brings this up like once a week.
I have not moved on, so I don't know how they do it. He's giving her this tour also, and he's like, Rosalie and Emmett's room, Carlisle's office, Alice's room. Does she not share a room with Jasper? Are they one of like those couples that are like so evolved that they don't share a room?
I don't know.
Don't sleep together, so.
Like, there's no reason that they don't all get their own
They
space.
Must have beds. Yeah, but the rest of them have sex. He's the only one that doesn't fuck, so maybe he doesn't get a bed for that reason
alone.
But
do they fuck on a bed?
They must. Okay. They must.
Do they fuck in the house
when other
people
are gone?
I don't know. This is what I'm thinking. If you are invincible, super strong, incredibly like flexible, perfect, the ideal human body, do you have sex on a bed?
The forest.
Like, do you go into the forest?
I feel like they would want the normalcy of the bed.
But like, who?
Like Carlisle and Esme.
Want that? Yeah, Carlisle and Esme.
I think, and Rose and Emmett, they used to have their own house. They don't right now though. So maybe they just take long hiatuses from having sex. Because they're bored.
I have so many questions. It's like, why do we have sex on beds? Convenience?
Tradition? I think it's hard to have sex on other things.
I think so too, but if you're a vampire, it might not be.
I was going to say they can get lazy, but they don't because they don't get tired. They don't exert themselves.
I have so many questions.
Yeah, that is weird. It's probably convention.
Yeah. Liberate. They need to liberate themselves.
They do marriage, so they probably do bed. I don't know. They do bed.
Too bad. No, but I think like to your point, to your original point, like there's no reason why they don't each have their own room. Like they all have their own individual interests. Like,
I guess,
and
the,
like probably
just the logic is so skewed. I guess
it's like I feel like Stephanie Meyer's projecting humanity on these vampires that don't need it.
I think more accurately, she's projecting heterosexuality on these vampires who don't need it.
If they don't sleep, there's no reason for them to like share a room, because that's like the symbolism of sharing a room is that you sleep together in it, and it's like your place that you come together at the end
and they
of
don't
the night.
And they don't even need to do it for financial reasons.
You get to hear the story of Carlisle.
Just yeah, the Spark beginning of it. The SparkNotes version of Carlisle's story, yeah. Just like a healthy, humbling reminder that Carlisle is 23 years old and that we are 24 years old.
Ew.
I know. Oh, no. We are older than Carlisle.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
We've reached the point in our life where we're older than our favorite vampire dad. Yeah, so this is kind of like an interlude into Carlisle's story, so...
These vampires in the 1600s are speaking
in Latin. Yeah, they're very removed from society.
Yeah, it seems like they've been slow to adapt to change in this way. Or maybe there's some sort of like traditional reason that they would speak Latin if they are from like Rome and they're associated with the Volturi. I could see them
still
speaking Latin because, you know, that's super old. People were not speaking Latin in a non-ecclesiastical or like church related setting at this point in time.
Carlisle thinks they must have been ancient.
Yeah, like they must be like very fun and fresh and sexy that they speak Latin. Like,
yeah. I know we talked extensively about Corrine when we did season one, Life and Death, but I don't know if we talked about this. Carlisle's changed because he is hunting vampires. That's like a very active role. He's like pursuing a vampire and is attacked. And Corrine gets changed so a vampire can get revenge on her father. So she has a very passive role in being changed.
Yeah. The whole reason Carlisle is seeking out vampires is because he, like, his dad has kind of passed the
Which
torch.
Doesn't happen to Corrine. I thought that was interesting. Gendered difference? Gender roles?
For
gender
sure.
roles in the vampire hunting world.
Gender forking?
Gender forking? Yeah, that's the end of the chapter.
Yes, that is all.
We're cruising to Midnight Sun. That is like
we absolutely
the destination.
Are.
I see it. Light at the end of the tunnel. Oh, we should plug something real quick. Yeah, let's plug our favorite house plant because I went plant shopping yesterday.
Oh, great. I would like to plug my pothos.
Pothos. Yes.
I have two now. Probably the younger one I'm a little more proud of right now. The leaves are really bright and doing really well.
My favorite plant right now, I know the other day I told you I had 12 plants, but yesterday I got 8 more. So now I have 20 plants.
Jesus Christ. Where are you getting plants right now?
My mom and I went to 3 different nurseries in rural
For
Maine
sure.
yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Near where she lives. But my favorite plant right now, or like the plant that I have the most emotional connection to right now, is my, like, it's like a clover or a shamrock plant that my grandmother gave me. I can't remember which it is. And it's like basically a grass or like a weed. Like, it's so mm-hmm. easy to take care of. But a couple months ago, I killed it on accident because I converted a chemical spray bottle into a water spray bottle, but I didn't clean it out enough. And I sprayed it basically chemicals, and it killed it entirely. And I was like, I'm a fucking idiot. And then I just kept watering it for like probably a month. And then like mm-hmm. like a week ago, it started sprouting up again. And then like ever since then, it's been rapidly sprouting, and I have flowers in there now.
Wow.
I'm very proud of it. Okay, well, it's been 2 hours and 45 minutes, so...
It certainly has.
Yeah. you want to do the sign-off?
Thanks for listening. That's all, Forks. Genderforking. All of season one is now streaming.
To stay updated about the podcast, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at genderforking.
For more Twilight content from us, you can follow our blog at bowlingshirtbellas.tumblr.com. For other inquiries, email us at bowlingshirtbellas@gmail.com.
If you're interested in supporting the production and maintenance of this podcast, head to patreon.com/genderforking. The music you are hearing is from O Lucifer.